After I watched the spinny thing spin for about 35 seconds and wondered if we had been interrupted before we started today, but we have not. So we are live. This is episode 3818, 3,818 times we have gotten together here on the Survival Podcast. And today's Wednesday. That's usually an interview day. And today is a normal day, but it's a cool day because Ryan Steva from the Expert Council will be with us in just a moment. We're actually going to have over the next 3 months, most of, not all of, but most of the Expert Council on the show with others interspersed in between them as they come in. And I think that's important. I want every once in a while to bring these folks on. They do a lot of work for you guys. I want them to get broader exposure, you know, than just a 7 to 8 minute segment a couple times a month. I also want you to know them better so that you know what to ask them. And so when you guys get those Thursday shows, that's all on you to content, really. You guys need to get information to me about, you know, the subject matter you want discussed by Expert Council members. And you send that email to jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com with TSPC expert in the subject line, and we'll get back to you. Keep that in mind today as we have Ryan on. We had Nick Ferguson on last week. Ryan Steva this week. I mean, you're getting a hell of an education here from some guys that work really hard to serve you. So help them help you by getting more questions in for us. So what are we going to be talking about today? Well, probably a bunch of stuff, but we're going to be really talking about water for every homestead. This is something that Ryan teaches classes in, and it is one of the most important subjects there is into proper homestead management. And lack of it is a big part of why many homesteaders fail. You know, your plants will not grow without water. That doesn't work. I mean, you might live in a place where it rains enough to get away with some practices that are maybe not the best. But in the end, we all need water. We need it to drink. We need it for animals. We need it for our plants. We need it for the landscape. We need it for the ecosystem. And I could keep going, but I won't, because Ryan's going to talk all about that in just a minute. Before we bring him on, though, I would just like to remind you guys about an upcoming class that you can take with myself and Tom LoCicero, which is Become Dangerous with ChatGPT. This is a course for solopreneurs, solo entrepreneurs, small business owners, and things like that. It is not a course to learn how to use ChatGPT to organize your closet or to use ChatGPT to teach your kid about history in 1863. It is a course that is for business owners and marketing people to better market their products and services. It is a tactical boot camp style course over 40 days. It will basically teach you how to turn ChatGPT into who I used to be 20 years ago before I started the podcast, when I had major marketing clients all over the country and even a couple that were international. And it is really good for that. GPT and AI in general doesn't do everything great. It does some things really well. This, it does really well if you know how to operate it. We will teach you how to do that. And I'll just give you kind of an idea of the value. We sell this course for $300. We only take 100 people per round. Tom and I kind of guide you through the whole thing. We drop you a day's work once a day every morning. You work through that work. We build as we go. So $300 for 40 days of instruction, that sounds good to begin with. But let me put it to you this way. If you hired me to do this for you 20 years ago, it was 20 to 25, 30 grand, depending on who you were and what was going on. Add inflation to that. You will have the ability to gain this type of insight into your business, your market, your customer base, and it is not just marketing. It's about developing standard operating procedures. It's about turning your business from a side hustle into a true operation. So please check it out and pre-register. Go to jackslaws.com to register for that course. And if you do not pre-register for the course, when we go ahead and open it up for enrollment, you ain't going to get in. So make sure you take the opportunity while you can. With that, I want to bring our special guest on, Ryan Steva. Ryan, welcome to the Survival Podcast, I should say again.
Yeah, thanks, Jack. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you back on the air for an interview, not just for a segment. Can you tell people, I mean, we get people coming in every day, never heard this show before. This might be their first episode. They don't know who and what Orion Steva is or why he's here. So could you tell us a little bit about your background and what you do to help people?
Sure. Yeah. So my background is, in my early 20s, I had a major health crisis, which is kind of how so many people get into this kind of world. And since then, I've learned a lot. I had to change a lot in my lifestyle pretty early and live differently. And as I did that, I found people who were wanting to homestead like I was doing to produce my own food, and realized that I could do it as a business, you know, after losing several jobs kind of right in a row from weird circumstances. So, yeah, that's kind of how, that's the nutshell version of how I got to doing what I'm doing. But I absolutely love it because I've always enjoyed, you know, teaching and bringing information that might not be otherwise easy to grasp and trying to break it down to something simple. It's just something I've always enjoyed, but I've had no interest in being, you know, a school teacher or part of, you know, I was always pushing back on teachers in school and, you know, asking the questions that they always hate, like, what is the circumstance where I'll use this? Not to be annoying and not do it, but because I'm like, I'm not going to hold on to this information if I don't know, like my brain just won't keep it unless I know what the practical application is. So I've always really loved teaching and learning for that matter, but I've always really hated the educational system. And I grew up as, you know, in the 90s as one of the earliest generations of homeschoolers. And so, you know, not that I'm perfectly normal and I don't want to be, but the people that I was, you know, in these homeschool groups and things with were like the kids who couldn't go to school because they were just too out there.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So, today's subject is water for every homestead and being kind of well read in the regenerative agriculture, permaculture space. I'm like, I see what he did there. You know, you're kind of calling on PA Yeoman's water for every farm. And I think that's really cool. And, Yeoman understood deeply how important water was to farmers, and it's, you know, homesteaders are kind of like small scale farmers. Exactly. So it's really important to us. In fact, Yeoman, of course, coming from a very arid region of Australia, really had to get it right. But you know, with that in question, when you say water for every homestead, what do you actually mean by that? And is true water security truly realistic for the average homesteader?
Well, it's a sliding scale, right? So it's kind of like, you know, self-sufficiency. How far on that sliding scale can you get? And so, yeah, it may not be doable to be totally water independent, but you can be a lot more water secure. So the further you get on that sliding scale, the more secure you're going to be with your homestead, with what kind of food you can produce, how long you can go without, you know, without water inputs from your local municipality. And a big part of that is understanding not only water cycles, but how to store water, because we all think of, you know, tanks or wells or whatever, but there's a lot more to understanding and using and storing water in the system than just those kind of, like, you know, consolidated water locations that we all generally think of when we think of water for a homestead.
Gotcha. Can you explain the water cycle in a way that helps homesteaders make better design decisions in the land? I mean, we all learned about the water cycle in like junior high or high school in science class, ecology class, whatever. But I think that just based on some of the comments people make in general to the point of being like writing it off, to the other point of like all the water's getting used, like both of those extremes just kind of deny the concept of the water cycle. So clearly there's some educational opportunity there.
Yeah. I mean, you can get really deep into it and there's some really amazing stuff that goes on, but really the start of it is the entire water cycle is solar powered. So we're looking at the sun hitting the earth and growing trees. And one of the major, the awesome things about trees and really anything green is that for them to get the mineral substance that they need, they actually need to evapotranspirate. So they need to let water into the air somewhere between 90 and 95% of the water that they uptake with their roots from way down in the soil or even in, you know, like water layers, various water layers, they're pulling that up. Now that's getting evaporated into the sky so that those trees can consolidate and condense minerals and actually grow. And so that creates, obviously, you've also got just general evaporation from surface water and things as well. But that's basically this solar water pump that's pumping water up into the sky, which means you're creating potential energy by moving that water up. And so when we think about water capture and using water on homestead, if we're aware that the higher in the landscape we catch that, the more potential energy it has, we can really benefit from that as opposed to, you know, letting it come further down or wash away. And so what a lot of people don't really think about is that we can store that in the soil or in the water systems. And so we can take that water from, you know, up high on the landscape as a, you know, it rains and we capture it up high. We can either store it in the soil or store it in a tank or whatever up high. And now we're keeping potential energy, or, you know, using swales and key lines and things, which we can talk a little bit more about what each of those are. Using those systems to hold water in the soil, or using ponds to hold water on top of, you know, on top of the soil or in the surface. Those are all ways that we can think of holding that water up high and just reducing entropy. So essentially what we're doing is we're taking the solar power that's pumping this water up, and we're reducing entropy and storing it like a battery. So it's like we're creating water batteries by storing the water up high, reducing entropy, and keeping it for later. And we can either do that with something like a tank, or we can do something, or a pond, or we can get it into the soil, which there's a lot of different ways to increase not only the absorbability in the soil, but also to increase how much the capacity of the soil to hold. So that kind of gives you a little bit of idea of this cycle of water going up and coming down and where we can catch it for the most benefit.
So I want to give Ryan a kudos there for rolling through that very well. For those of you that do not see the video version of today's show, I just completely disappeared and had to do a little remote redneck engineering to get back into my own feed. And he just rolled through it like a pro. So well done, man. I think I got most of it, so we can proceed on with the interview.
I didn't know if one of your dogs was bugging you or something. But
no, it was an internet connectivity issue that has been at least temporarily resolved. Probably the NSA or the CIA microwave beaming my house or something. Who the hell knows? Anyway,
got to paint your roof.
And for those of you that might take that seriously, it's an effing joke. Anyway, you describe water as a battery. And I know in one of your segments, I kind of followed up with that as well. Like everything is a battery, and we can do things with water to increase water security if we use the battery concept of water. What does that mean to you, and how can a homestead store water the way that we would store energy in something like a nickel, you know, battery or what have you?
Yeah, really it comes down to the concept of potential energy. So holding on to that potential energy that we've got because of the solar, you know, this whole solar water pump system that we call the water cycle. And so holding it higher on the landscape is holding it with higher potential for coming downhill. And that, you know, that's great for tanks. So there's a really simple calculation for PSI, which is helpful to know, but it's 0.43 PSI per foot of elevation change. So every foot of drop in a pipe from, let's say your tank's up here and your pipe is dropping down here, every foot of drop, you'll get 0.43 PSI. And so if you do 2 feet, now you're pretty close to 1 PSI, not quite there. If you do 100 feet, you'll have 43 PSI. So we, you know, we all know what water towers are. We've seen them up high. That's not especially practical for a homestead, but I've set up several homesteads where we're using solar energy to pump water up, using it for the pump that's direct powered up to a tank, usually somewhere between about 50 to 100 feet up a hill, and the tank just sits on top of the hill. So it's not some giant structure holding up a ton of water. It's just the tank being uphill. And then that same line that it's being pumped up with is the passive pressure back. And that's worked really well.
Yeah, I think you can do a lot with that even in relatively flat environments because you do get movement and even like a foot or two of elevation change. But if we add to that in something like water catchment off a roof where we're using poly tanks, we also have something called volumetric pressure there as well. And I've seen people do irrigation using drip with standard drip irrigation line, nothing special about it at all, with just like some plumbed together IBCs. Mm-hmm. And seen that work really well. I think people maybe think they need more than they need to utilize some of these more passive strategies.
Yeah, for sure. And IBCs can stack on top of each other. And so you can get a little bit of, you know, a little bit of height. Most drip irrigation systems are intended to be run at like 15 PSI or so. However, you know, if you just let it, if you wait longer, it'll drip as much. It's a timing thing. I'm a huge fan of soaker hoses of all things.
Okay.
Because soaker hoses are the same way. They can work at really low pressure. They just take longer to do so. And they're inexpensive. You can go get them at Harbor Freight or Amazon or wherever. And you just kind of snake them along your, you know, do rows and you snake them along the rows. And even an IBC tank that's, you know, stacked just one on top of the other, or a poly tank that, you know, it's filled to the top. So whatever your height of that top is, you'll have that pressure. But you can use pumps too. A simple transfer pump is, you know, I like the, what are they? The RV, 12 volt RV transfer pumps. Yeah. There's a few different brands that make them, but they're anywhere from about $60 to $100. They'll run off of a standard car battery or, you know, power adapter or whatever. But they have a 40 PSI shutoff or 45 PSI shutoff in most cases, which is really handy. So you can hook it to a garden hose and you can actually use a sprayer or, you know, your standard drip systems. It is just a great way to simply increase your pressure so that you can use it in more standard practices.
What I love about the SureFlow ones, and that's what I have for my poly tanks, is that if you get an AC one, it's still a DC one. Mm-hmm. Right? It's basically you disconnect the power converter and now you have DC. So one pump is both pumps. And it's kind of crazy because I think the AC version costs like $5 more. Mm-hmm. So if I was buying one and I would plan to run it in a DC system, I would still buy the AC one because a separate part is like $30.
Right.
And it's just like I'll put it on the shelf because I never know if I might need to use it for, you know, repurpose it.
Yeah, I mean that's great. The more you can stack things and the more you realize that one thing can do something different than what you thought it did, and when you start to realize that basically all motors are, well, a lot of motors, especially in tools and things, are actually DC motors, that it's being converted in some way to use. That kind of resilience, mental resilience of understanding how something works so you can modify it to your need in an emergency or in a tough situation is really important.
Yeah. What's kind of some of the biggest mistakes you see homesteaders make when it comes to water management?
Just not planning it properly. So I would say as they kind of think about it, you need to actually put your goals down. And I harp on this a lot, is actually writing down your goals. Like, what are the things that you want to accomplish on your homestead? What is your kind of end goal? And then plan the water from there. I think people also tend to, it's easier to capture water downhill because usually, you know, you're capturing it off your roof and then you might put your tank a bit downhill because it's easier to get the water there. But then you have to pump it back up. So, and I also think people don't think about the soil, you know, adding biochar or running ruminants or doing other things to build the soil organic matter. That's going to do a lot to hold the water in the landscape. So you know, now maybe instead of needing 10,000 gallons worth of water to get you through a drought, now maybe you need 1,000 gallons worth of water because your soil is doing most of that work.
Yeah, there's a lot I think that can be done with from an earthwork standpoint in that, you know, we have places where, as crazy as it is, it's illegal to put a pond in without begging 57 bureaucrats to sign off on all the paperwork to do it. But you can put swales in.
Mm-hmm.
And then, well, you can't have a pond. Well, that's not a pond. That's a ditch. And
that's right.
Come back in a week and all the water's gone. But it's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's infiltrated into the land, or other types of earthworks that are even less obvious, things like terracing, especially if you throw in a terrace with like a 1 degree back pitch, it's basically a big flat swale,
yep,
but doesn't even look like one. And so there's a lot of ways around the bureaucracy with holding water in the land. Mm-hmm. And in many ways that's better because the evaporation rate is much lower, assuming that like you said, improving the soil, either grazing, biochar, other things to get organic matter in there. Because if you have, really super fine sand soil, or really coarse sand soil, the water just, you push it in there, but it's 30 foot down before it hits anything that holds it. So you also have to think about that's your approach, improving soil, increasing organic matter, that type of thing.
Yeah. Or vice versa. If you've got just clay soils and you're trying to do swales and they're really heavy clay soils, that water is going to sit on the surface until it evaporates. It's going to kill all the standard plants that you want to grow in the ditch of your swale. So in either case, adding organic matter, adding biochar, adding the chicken compost that comes out of my coop, whatever it is, adding that is going to make a big difference. And the other thing, so I think swales and key lining is a really important concept that understanding contour, all that is difficult for a lot of people to kind of wrap their brains around. But once they do, it's such an aha moment. It's such a big light bulb that comes on. For example, I live in a well over 200 year old homestead house, and I realized several years ago that somebody had put these swales up my hill. So I found some really great LIDAR, free LIDAR resources. And I started looking, I'm like, there's all these half moons. They're not like half moon, water catchments. And there's a giant swale about 400 feet on the hill above my house that you'd never notice by eye. And they're all water catchment systems to improve the spring that's downhill from my house. So people can create or better spring, make springs better by doing these simple earthworks like key lining, like half moon water catchments. And the old timers were doing it. They probably didn't even have a name for it. They just went and did it. Should we kind of cover what a key line is and what?
Yeah, I think so. As you do that, I've only gotten one question so far, but it was, do you use key line design?
So
let's go ahead and talk about that a bit.
Sure. So first of all, I think people need to understand what contour is. I'm going to share my screen here quick if I can. Thank you. So this is actually Mark Shepard's New Forest Farms, and this is the USGS website. Which it's a little convoluted to use because of the way they did the layers here, but mm-hmm. it's really helpful in understanding. And I know people are listening, so this is something to go to the video if you can. Let's see. There are hillside elevation is going to be your LIDAR. And then there is, so that's right here. And then there's contours, elevation contours. So you can see these contour patterns here. Oops. Where it follows the contour of the land. That means where these lines go on like a topo map or something, if you're looking at a topo map, is going to be level across that region. And so these lines represent level, and you can see that at Mark Shepard's farm, they're not quite right, but on Mark Shepard's farm, he's got in the valleys, he's actually got these catchment points, and right here is a key line. So for those who can see it, there's on the video, there's a key line right in the valley that catches water, and then it hits a swale and moves out along the peak. And so that keeps that peak hydrated. And understanding that is understanding how these contours work and how to follow them is really vital for understanding swales and key line systems. So I don't think I need this visual anymore, Jack. Thanks for putting that up. So as far as this is concerned, the that key line point is going to be a place where the hill starts to roll off. So right as the hill of the from the top of the hill, right as it starts to roll off a little bit harder, that's your key line. And so you basically you can put in ponds there, you can put in a swale and move it out across the landscape to hit those peaks instead of all of the water rushing down the valley. And then I think the last part of that is if you look at contour lines, what you'll see is that the contour lines, if you want to know where water is going to flow, you go 90 degrees off contour. So exactly perpendicular to the contour line is the direction the water is going to flow. So I don't know if that helps people understand, you know, visually how that's going to work.
Okay. How do you think people should think about integrating all this stuff together? We've kind of touched on this already, but swales, trees, rotational grazing, bringing in things like biochar, compost extracts, and things like that. How does this kind of holistically solve this problem? Because I think one of the big problems we have with water security is that people think very linear and one-dimensionally. Mm-hmm. I have an irrigation system tied into city water, and I have sprinklers. I don't need to worry about it. Okay. Or, you know, I have, like me, I have a well, and I irrigate my garden with my well. I would prefer to irrigate more with roof catch than I do because I run out of it, and there is some salinity issues when we're pulling from a well. Mine happens to be really low, but it's still there, and it does accumulate over time. So how do we kind of cobble this together to make everything more secure rather than relying on one or two things, one or two components, one or two design elements that are become that way very brittle? If you rely on your well and your power goes out, you're effed. Right. If you rely on city water and somebody down the road yanks the main feed up with a backhoe and it happens and it happens to be one of the hottest days of the year, your garden could be toast by the time the water comes back on. So how do we put these things together and make everything more resilient?
Yeah, well, that's kind of the thing is you're making a web of various things. So in a spider web, if you cut one line in it or one part of the web, it still is together. It might not be as perfect, but it's still intact and doing its job. And so that's kind of what we're thinking about. So maybe you've got a sprinkler system with your well, largely, it's basically largely a backup system, but you've set up your gardens in such a way that, that they're a lot more resilient. So I know, Jack, you've got limestone close to the surface and
very close.
You've got some issues with in-ground growing, but in my case, where I'm at, what I've found is that in Tennessee rains quite a bit, but we get several months essentially without rain a lot of years in that, you know, hottest part of the end of the summer. And I don't have an irrigation system set up in my garden. I use, I've improved the organic matter and I use wood chips. And so I have a lot less evaporation. I've also got water with the wood chips. It actually pulls water back down into the soil from dew and other moisture in the air. So it keeps that moderated quite well. So I don't actually water my garden, which is really handy, other than to get, you know, plants started. And that makes a big difference. But then I have water as a backup if I need it. So if it gets really dry, really hot, I can water my garden if I need to. So understanding those systems that we typically think of as this is what I'm going to do because I have it, like I'm going to water my garden with my well, making those kind of secondary to improving the soil. So, you know, whether it's running ruminants, whether it's putting in biochar, you know, putting wood chips on top of the soil, whatever it is, we're increasing the soil's capacity to hold water or to keep water in place. And that reduces our dependence on some of these other systems, and they can be a backup instead of a primary.
Yeah, I think like the soil improvement too cannot be understated or overstated that no matter what you're doing from a standpoint of irrigation or waiting for the next rain, the longer the soil holds onto the moisture, you know, unless we turn it into a bog and it goes anaerobic or something, the less dependent you are on some form of bringing water to the site. And even where I'm at, like you said, like where my main garden is, it's literally 6 inches and it is a slab like a sidewalk underneath it of limestone. So going in ground there wouldn't work. But in the 2 foot deep raised beds we put in, we have focused extensively on improving the soil that's in those so that when that, you know, that drip irrigation goes off in the middle of summer for 5 minutes and it's enough to get it through. When it gets really hot, like mid August, I'll run that twice a day. But if I had shitty soil in there, I would have to run it almost continuously. And I certainly wouldn't be able to run it for 5-10 minutes a couple times a day. I would have to be putting, you know, an hour's worth of water on it at a time because it would just go down through and then it would just flood out underneath the beds, which, by the way, when we dumped the first soil in there that we could get our hands on before we started improving it, it wasn't quite that bad, but it was pretty close. I mean, you could water it for 10 minutes with drip and then there would be a puddle 5 minutes after the drip went off down on the ground. And because it just wasn't holding on to anything.
Well, and I bet when you started really digging into biochar and incorporating that into your gardens, I bet you saw a big difference in the amount of water you were using.
Hugely. And to the point where when I teach biochar, I say, if you threw out everything this does with microorganisms and, you know, sequestered carbon and all the rest of it, and you only looked at it from a standpoint of reduction in the need for irrigation, it's worth doing.
Right.
It's insane how effective it works. A few years ago when I was starting my seedlings, I made all of my potting soil from my compost, a little bit of perlite so you could see that it was mixed. That's the only reason it was in there. And about 15% biochar. And as I was doing that, I got kind of like a hair up my ass going like, well, how beneficial is this? And so I took a couple starts that were in my potting soil with the biochar, and then I made like another dozen of them or half dozen of them from Fox Farm soil, which is good soil. There's nothing wrong with it at all. It's a great brand of soil if you're going to buy in your potting soil. And I just like watered them the same, stuck them under the lights. You know, it's hot there. You've got all your grow lights and your heat mats and all. And like, how long can they survive? And the answer for the Fox Farm stuff was miserable in 2 days with no water.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a little container. And then on the third day, like it's almost dead. And by the fourth morning, like that, you wake up that fourth day, like you could do whatever. It's like trying to resuscitate the dead. And the stuff with the biochar, and it lasted almost 10 days. I mean, I let it go till it died.
Mm-hmm.
So it, even in a little like 4-inch pot, it more than doubled the resilience for water. Now, you're a long way for, you know, you got to put a lot of biochar in some soil to get to 15%. But the point is germane, right? Like this works. My numbers, I think, are 1 pound of biochar can hold about 7.5 pounds of water.
Yeah, I've independently verified that. Yeah,
that's almost a gallon per pound. So then if we put 500 pounds of biochar into a system, you know, we're sitting somewhere around 450-ish gallons of additional water holding capacity. That's, you know, 2 IBCs.
Mm-hmm.
That's like having 2 IBCs in your soil. And I really don't think people get that.
Yeah, I don't either. And catching it while it's falling and holding it there until it's needed, and your soil's ability to do that is incredible. And there's so much to say with like watering because you're losing so much water too. So if if you're relying on your well or whatever you're using to water your system, but you're not improving the soil, not only do you have to use a lot more water, but that water, most of it's going to just evaporate off because it's not going to get into the soil well. And you had mentioned microbes and like just, you know, even in the biochar and thinking about what it does, ignoring the microbes. Well, the microbes are the importance of those in soil life and in the mitigation of moisture is you can't even fathom it. I mean, Matt Powers should, you should have him on to talk about this or something, but the way that microbes interact with moisture and with the water in the system and the way that they help mitigate it and change it and move it. And the systems are so incredibly amazing and beautiful and complex. And we just don't have an appreciation for it because we can't visually see it. So we don't know what all these little life forms are doing in, you know, cation exchange or in, you know, moisture movement from one place to another, or in, you know, just improving the soil in such a way that it has the right electrical conductivity and everything else. It's fascinating information that I know very little about.
The microbes are important, and to me, like, the main focus there needs to be getting a good amount of beneficial fungi into the system, mm-hmm. both mycorrhizal and other. And the reason I say that is not because the bacterium are not important. If you have a good fungal system, you have a great bacterial system. Like, right. it's when people say fungal dominant, it just means there's a lot of fungus in the system. It's still the bacteria completely outnumber the fungi. And when you can do that, you know, your mycorrhizal fungi, they can't even exist without plant roots. And so when you add mycorrhizal to your system, you're literally intentionally infecting your plants, but don't mm-hmm. let that word scare you. You know, it's science, bitches. It's a good infection. And
it is a good infection.
They connect themselves to the roots, and then they have a symbiotic exchange with that plant, and they'll give that plant water. So mm-hmm. you can have a fungal hyphae network that's your entire bed. And if they happen to be tied into your tomato plant, that's like, you know, giving your tomato plant a root system that goes end to end in your 8-foot bed.
Yeah.
Which is pretty freaking crazy fantastic when you think about it. And then all the other things you're talking about, like the cation exchange and stuff. So what's more resilient to being stressed a little bit from water? A plant that is getting all the nutrient it needs, or a plant that's nutrient deficient? You know, kind of mm-hmm. like that little cold that went around about 5 years ago that it turned out all the people were dying from it that weren't 1,000 years old had massive nutrient deficiencies. And so plants work on that same premise. The more healthy the plant is, then the less water it needs to be healthy. And that's kind of crazy. I need to go do something. So you roll with that answer. I got another option to deal with.
Yeah. Well, if it's not the internet, it's something, right?
Yeah. It's a dog.
Yeah. Right. So yes, I think the need for fungal hyphae is really important too. It's a great point because the fungal hyphae can connect from one plant to another. It can create the ability for those plants to actually talk amongst each other and even share nutrients. It's the fungus is the pathway for all these systems to work together and to share moisture, to share just about everything. The fungal networks are absolutely 100% important. And the more friable, I can't think of the right word, but the soil is, and the more substance you have in organic matter, the more that fungal hyphae can move through the soil and connect between the different plants.
I think the word you're looking for there is aggregation.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you get your little particles of soil. They kind of are stuck together with bioglues by these microbes. And so then you get a lot more air in your soil, and then the air space can be occupied by water. Like perfect soil, and this is like not about nutrient content, or like perfect soil, we talk about it, but we don't know what it is about 50% solid matter, 25% air, and 25% water.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do that without aggregation. Like you were talking about the clay earlier and how the water will sit on top of it. It will until we manage to aggregate the clay.
Correct.
And then you dig up clay, and until you dig down deep enough, people look at clay and go, well, that's a loam.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I remember Elaine Ingham, the first time I met her, she was talking about doing that using, you know, compost teas. And she was like, oh, that's interesting that you think that. Take it away and go test it. And they would test it. Come back, this is almost all clay. It's clay organic matter, right? Like, yeah, we can change that structure and that crumb structure. And I don't know about you, man, but I just think this is one of those things that, like, humans that know nothing still innately know that. Mm-hmm. When you pick up soil in your hands and you show it to somebody who's never grown a turnip or a radish, but it's that nicely aggregated, deep, rich, dark soil. There's so, you see the eyes kind of light up. Like, they know intrinsically that that is what soil is supposed to look like. People that don't know the difference between dirt and soil still know that's better. You know what I'm saying?
You can take a person out of an office building and give them some soil from a, or I guess dirt, you know, yeah, from a cornfield, and give them some soil from your garden that you've been building over the last 10 years and tell them to smell it and then ask them which one is better.
Yeah.
Like, there's an innate knowing in the brain that that one, it's got fungus, it's got bacteria, which we were really scared of and think that we should kill off, right? Because they're dangerous.
Yeah.
And it smells so much better. You put a blindfold on them, have them smell it, and they'll go, they'll pick the garden soil every single time, 100% of the time, no questions asked.
Yeah.
And they could be afraid of dirt, right? And they'll still pick that one.
Oh God, my grandkids, their mom has them terrified of every bacteria, everything you wash your hands 87 times a day and all. I just told my grandson the other day, he was over here. I said, buddy, I want you to breathe in and breathe out. He's like, okay. So he does it. I'm like, you said 60,000 toxins roughly go through your body, mm-hmm, right? We are able to deal with that. But most of the stuff in good soil is not harmful anyway. I mean, correct. Another thing about Elaine is she would always say, if you wouldn't drink the compost tea from your compost, you're making shitty compost. Right. And I don't know if I want to push it that far, but I've seen plenty of people do it. I'm just not really into drinking compost water. Like,
yeah.
Now, to be clear for people out there listening, she's talking about finished compost, right?
Yeah.
That's what, if the steam's coming off and it still smells like duck shit. No, that's not what she was talking about, but.
No, and she said something in passing once that I noticed, and I thought that's pretty cool. But she had talked about actually making a compost tea bath. Mm. So to get the you know, your skin biome back in place, to actually make a, you know, take some compost, just a small bag of compost, and dip it in your bath and let it soak for a bit before you get in, and you can actually, because, you know, we've all destroyed our skin microbiome with soaps, or, you know, bathing in chlorine, or, you know, that comes from the municipality, or whatever it is, you know, using Head and Shoulders, or
yeah,
whatever. Even if we've changed that at some point in our life, that's how we function most likely. And so she talked about it as a way to restore, you know, your skin biome. And I thought it was a really great idea.
Renegade Orchards. Elaine had balls of steel. Ain't no way I'm drinking compost tea. I think what she had was supreme confidence in the quality of the compost that she was making. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is also a woman that could put compost under a microscope and say, not only is that good compost, that compost is optimized for strawberries.
Yeah.
There's a rare breed. We lost something when we lost. For those that don't know Elaine, she was a pioneer in this world of soil biology, and she gave her whole life to teaching others how to do it, and she passed away just about a month ago. So
yeah, she's gonna be missed in the community,
man. I learned so much from her. I first met her in person at the first Permaculture Voices out in California, and there was a lot of things I thought I knew, and then when she explained it, I'm like, not only did I understand it better, I can actually teach it better now. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's like, the best teachers make other teachers into better teachers. Like, that's how you know somebody's really a teacher. How do you think we should go about and think about collecting and storing roof water effectively, especially on smaller pieces of land, suburban, your quarter to half acre properties and stuff? Like, that's actually the number one design element that you have,
mm-hmm,
that you can use to build up a reserve of water.
Well, yeah, in permaculture, how does it go? It's water access.
Water access structure.
Structures. There we go. Thank you. And so that's really one of the first things you want to think about when you're looking at your homestead, whether it's built already or you're building it, is to understand how the water flows across it and then how to capture it if you need to. And so, you know, we're talking largely for collection. We're going to be talking tanks and roof catchment. One of the big things, mistakes people make is storing too little. So they're like, oh, I've got a 55-gallon drum and I'll run my downspout into it. Or, you know, not having any type of filter system. So you want to go and use the water, but now it clogs everything you thought you were going to run it through. Or,
yeah.
So those are two big issues. One thing I like to say is if you ever see the, you know, advertisements for a downspout diverter, it always has it sitting like right next to a barrel or a collection system. And my thought is you always put that downspout diverter as high as possible. So basically just under the gutter, and then you run a pipe down to where you want it. So now you've got water pressure on your side. So maybe you have 10 PSI. And so you could even run that pipe out and over to, I don't know, your chicken coop where you've got a 55-gallon drum that you've got waterers on the side of or something like that. And so you can move that water somewhere instead of just putting it straight into the barrel, but also you're going to get more water from the diverter because you're actually kind of creating a suction event with the water that's going down that pipe into whatever your storage is. Mm. So that's a quick tip on that. I have two favorite water downspout diverters. My top favorite one is the Munjalin Smart Filter, and Sean Mills actually introduced me to this, and it's this amazing system that really filters the water really well, but it outlets into a 3-inch pipe. So you can fill, I set one up on a, I think it's a 2000 square foot roof on one side of a barn with a 3000 gallon tank. And we had a very hard rain for about 45 minutes right after I installed the tank. And the tank was, I'd say it was probably about 7/8 full. There's just a tiny bit at the top that wasn't full in that amount of time because the diverter is just so good at moving a high volume of water and filtering it. But, there's, you know, you can do a lot. That one's really expensive. It's like $300, but okay. It's worth it.
And what was that called?
The Munjalin Smart Filter. Yeah. Don't ask me to spell it. I'm pretty dyslexic. But it's MONJ something or other.
JOLIN Smart Filter Mini. Is that it?
Yeah. Yeah. The Smart Filter Mini is what I typically use, but they have a larger one as well.
Okay. I'm going to bring that up here in just a second. I tried to find it. I thought you said something like that and it auto corrected to Magellan who makes, you know, faucets. I'm like, that's can't possibly be it, but yeah, you're talking about this little guy right here. And it's almost, like you said, it's almost $300. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you able to show that on the screen?
Oh yeah. I thought I was. Let me get it up there. All right.
There it is.
I'm sitting there staring at the page, all proud of myself. And well, see, I used to have it. So as soon as I went to share something, it jumped up on the screen, but sometimes that's not good.
Right.
Because then you interrupt things. I was just trying to, you're trying to bring it on deck. And, I still have bad habits from that, I guess. But
so
yeah,
are there any pictures of the inside there, Jack?
Let me see if there are. Yeah, some other pictures. Let's see what we got here. We got this.
Yeah, that the blue. There you go. Yeah,
here we go.
All right. So again, I'll try to describe it for people just on audio. But yeah. Basically, there's this spring-loaded sock kind of thing inside, and the water comes through from the top, and that kind of sock is basically your filter, and so the water can push through that. And the harder it rains, the further that sock pushes down.
Okay.
And so the more water can push through it into that, the direct outlet below. And then the little bit of water that's needed to push some of the debris out and things is going to go out the right-hand side there on that other. So you'd hook up your downspout to the right-hand side, and you'd hook up your 3-inch.
So that part I've got expanded right there. That's water being delivered. Right.
No, that's water going to the downspout. So that's your wastewater essentially.
Okay.
That'll be your debris and downspout, and then that one.
That one's where so the water's not going through from the outside. The water's coming in from here inside the sock thing. It's kind of like a French drain pipe wrapped with filter wrap.
Yeah, and then that filter
out of there, that actually brings it down here into your catchment side. Okay.
Correct. And right. that'll take, you know, anywhere from 90 to 98% of the water that comes down your downspout, even in heavy rains, will get sent to your tank.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
And very clean water then too. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of times when you talk about clean water, like, well, yeah, I'm not probably drinking that anyway. Well, first of all, maybe you will someday, and there's additional things, but we're not really filtering it for that purpose. What we're filtering is debris, right. which becomes really important. First of all, if you keep doing it long time and you don't do that, you end up with a big, giant, skanky, nasty, anaerobic layer of shit in the bottom of your cistern or your catchment tank. The other thing, though, is since you have that suspended solids and you try to put it through something like drip irrigation, it clogs the holes.
Mm-hmm.
Or even when you're like, you know, most people are running some sort of a little screen, like a rubber hose washer with a screen on it for things like sprinklers and spray nozzles, I think you should be. And so then you're out and all of a sudden it looks like you have no water pressure. And so you go to take it off and you get sprayed in the face because it's just that screen is completely clogged and it's there to do its job. But it'd be better if it didn't have to do it so much and you didn't have to clean it out so often.
Yeah, there's some really great inline filters that you can hook up to your hoses. And that's true for city water, too. If you're, you know, if you have to use city water, you can get carbon, basically CTO inline filters. And I think they're generally sold as an RV filter, but they're great for gardens as well. They'll take out a lot of the chlorine, less of the chloramine, if that's what your utility uses. But they'll also take out a decent amount of the fluoride but they're really helpful like for city water for plants as well.
Yeah.
So people oftentimes want to do first flush systems. And I think I covered this in an expert segment a while ago, but I really kind of despise first flush systems because they're so prone to freezing. You've got this little hole at the bottom where the water is supposed to dribble out. But it's supposed to dribble out the same thing that's supposed to be catching the debris.
Yeah.
So that hole always plugs up.
Yeah.
A first flush system also means you're not going to collect small amounts of water. So like if you've got a dew, like a heavy dew that sits on your metal roof.
And that's what I've always thought. Yeah.
Yeah. You'll miss it from the first flush system, whereas the Monjolin or some of the other diverters will catch that a lot better.
Yeah, that's a great point because I have mornings this time of year, especially up till about June, when then the arid high pressure moves in and everything's brown. But up until about then, you know, I'll get up in the morning and I'll look out, I'll have a cup of coffee, look out of the back of the kitchen and like, did it rain? Well, it didn't rain. It's just roof moisture and it's, you know, dribbling out of the downspout. Right. I don't have any rain. I have rain catchment on the shop because it's all metal roof. I don't have any rain catchment on the house, but you know, if you're using something like that, then you're constantly picking up that dew drop and, you know, across a month or two, it's a significant amount of water.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially in times where you're not getting rain. Jack, I put a link in there or a thing to pull up on screen because this is the other downspout diverter I really like.
Yeah, I got to remove this one because it's still there, even though you don't see it. There you go.
All right. So I'll try to explain this one too. And you can see that image of the downspout diverter right next to the barrel instead of up high. But this little diverter is really cool because what it does is it uses the effect of surface tension. So when water's coming down your downspout, it almost never falls down the middle. It catches and kind of clings to the edge. And so as it goes down, this little $10 diverter, which is a lot more feasible than $300, it interrupts that water. And the debris ends up getting kicked kind of down and into the downspout. But then there's this little lip that collects the water and pushes it out the side. So this is the least expensive, most effective semi-filtering downspout diverter that I've found. So $10, you can put one on every single one of your downspouts, throw an IBC under it, and have some decent water collection for almost nothing.
And how much did you say these were, like $10?
Yeah, $10 a piece.
Yeah, that's pretty brain dead easy to work out to do. And I guess what you're saying is these are really good. They're not maybe as good as this other thing. It's $300, but you'd rather have really good ones everywhere than one in one place.
Yeah. I mean, this is a value play, right? So it's, I can collect water at a very low price and it does a good job.
Yeah.
A couple of things that don't work perfectly about this filter is one, it will get some debris through. So if you have small debris, it's going to go through and get in your water. And two, it doesn't do a lot of volume. So it'll catch small amounts of water. But once you hit enough volume that it's not going to run down a 3/4 inch hose,
yeah,
then, you know, you lose out on some of that water.
I've seen people do some pretty cool creative things too, to put water where they want it in a reserve. Like one of the guys in this audience, I don't know if you've ever met him because you haven't been here to one of my workshops, but he has been up to Tennessee a time or two, Aaron Hatch. He's okay. Got it, does all my, like AV stuff for the workshops. Really cool dude. And he wanted his tank, like, let's say, 20 feet away from the house.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to put a pretty good sized poly tank up a couple feet high over there. So you have volumetric and you have elevation pressure, but you got to get the water from the house over there. So If you put a 2,500 gallon tank up on a wooden tower, it better be a hell of a tower. That's a lot of weight. What he did, he threw a standard like 275 IBC on a really high tower, ran the water off the roof into that, and then ran piece 4-inch pipe out of the IBC over and into the tank. And that was able to fill that tank over there from this, you know, 2-story high IBC little mini tower over here. Yeah. And that way, you know, you could actually hold a substantial amount of water. And it was just like, I don't want that tank up there for what, I don't remember why, but it may have been not even practical to put it there.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's ways we can move that battery. I've also seen people do something really simple, like rain chains. And you don't get all the water, but you get a lot of water from, I've seen rain chains move water 30, 40 foot horizontally. There has to be some down to it, but I've seen some pretty creative things done with rain chains too.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many things you can do. One additional like little caution that I kind of learned the hard way years ago is if you're putting piping somewhere, make it bigger than you think. I think it should be. Moving water through a 1-inch PVC is a lot easier than moving water through a 1/2-inch PEX.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There's resistance. There's physical drag or pipe drag. I even have a calculator that will calculate it for you.
Yeah.
That does a great job. But, you know, I've had so many people put in, like, I had somebody put in 1-inch PEX, which PEX, the inside diameter or ID, is actually smaller than what it's rated for. So it's 0.88 inch, which when you're thinking volumetrically, 0.88 inches is way smaller than 1 inch. And they wanted to move water like 2,000 feet and uphill. And I'm like, you're going to have a trickle at the end. And they wanted like 5 gallons a minute. We're going to have to put in some 1.25 inch poly to actually make that work.
Yeah, I've got these little garden ponds and tanks and pitch and return systems and all. And the last one I put in, when I was putting in, I had a friend over and he said, man, this is 2-inch pipe. That's probably overkill and it's really expensive. Why didn't you use like 1.25 inch, 1.5 inch? And I'm like, because no man ever said, I wish my return lines were smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like there is no such thing as having a too big of anything you're trying to deliver water, especially something variable. Right. Like when you have variable pressure, or you also have things that over time in a system like that is different than water catch out of a house, but you do get some clogging and some things like that. And the more forgiveness you have, the longer you have to catch it and to unclog things, if that makes sense as well. Because, there's some pretty interesting things that come out of pipes like that when you flush them.
Right. Well, that's another point. Putting clean outs and valves.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So have a little T that comes up from your line with a valve on it. So you can pop that open and let it and use it as a clean out.
Yeah.
You know, have valves throughout your system because then you can divide and conquer if something goes wrong.
Yeah.
I do a lot of, spring maintenance for people in the area because there's a lot of people on, like a decent number of people on spring water in my region. And, all the old timers who used to do it are gone. So nobody knows how to work on these systems anymore. So all that's one of my little side business things. And so, one of the things I've noticed is people aren't putting valves in along the way. And so then you can't determine where a leak or a problem is or a clog because you can't turn on or turn off a valve.
Gotcha.
This is some freaking shit.
Yeah. I'm answering him. He's getting an answer right now. Here. There you go.
Nice.
Problem solved. Gone. Disappeared. It's interesting to me. People will bitch about, like, you don't like what we're talking about. It's not for you. Leave. But no, they got a bitch.
I'll take their comment. It'll drive the algorithms a little
bit.
Or something.
Yeah. It's on Facebook, though, so it doesn't really matter. Yeah. Anyway, do you think there is like a clear definitive answer to, do I use gravity for this or do I use pumps? My gut would answer? Be,
yeah.
if you can use gravity, do it, but that's not always doable with your goals. Like, because gravity doesn't fail, mm-hmm. right? We're not in outer space. Like, you know, it doesn't float. Stuff doesn't float away. You drop shit, it falls. So it's zero energy input required. The Earth is taking care of it with its mass, but it just doesn't always work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's going to be times when you've got a property where you really just don't have enough, you know, drop over the property, or a high point is going to be hard to get a tank to, whatever the circumstances. There are times I just say, if you can't, if it's not practical money wise, location wise, you know, topography wise to use gravity feed, then make sure you have some backups. Make sure you have an extra pump on the shelf. Make sure you have, you know, if one pump is AC, make sure you have a DC option. Make sure you can run it off of your car battery, or, you know, you have something you can run off of solar. So it's not that one has to work. I prefer gravity if you can store water as energy. But, you know, if you have to move it with electricity, not a huge deal. Just make sure you have some backup systems in case one fails.
You know, if you have a lot of water that needs to be moved, but it doesn't all need to be moved now, mm-hmm. there's always the opportunity to use very low energy to move small amounts of it at a time and put it up somewhere high and then let gravity do the work when you're in your short. Like, kind of that's that charging the battery type of thing. So what I'm saying is, you know, you get a little bitty pump that draws about 50 freaking watts. It is not going to move water uphill fast enough to irrigate even a medium sized garden. But if it puts the water up there and mm-hmm. it runs all the time until that tank that it's putting it in is full, you got plenty of time between when you pull water from that tank to when it fills itself back up, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there's lots of ways of thinking about this. You could do it with direct solar. And I think we've talked a bit about this before, but the idea of, you know, when the sun's shining, I can put together a system for, you know, anywhere from 40 to about $300 that will use direct solar to push water up to a tank uphill, and it'll just trickle in over time. And now you've, you know, you're storing that small amount of energy, but over a long enough period of time, you know, now you've got a substantial, it's like investing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You're putting a little bit away at a time until all of a sudden you realize you actually have something meaningful.
You know, earlier in the beginning of the conversation, we were talking about how, like, certain systems that don't have that much pressure, you can still run drip. And one of your statements was, well, yeah, and you just, maybe you have to let it run longer.
Mm-hmm.
That also is not a bad thing. The longer it takes for water to go in the soil, the more of it actually goes in the soil. That's kind of the whole mm-hmm. purpose of drip. Or, like you said, you like soaker hoses as well. Like, when you haven't had rain in a long time and you get like a huge downpour, but it lasts 20 minutes, you're like, well, that was pointless.
Right.
Right? And you go outside and you everything's like puddles everywhere, but, you know, a couple hours later, it all dries up and you move a half inch of dirt with your foot and it's bone dry underneath.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But if you get the same volume of rain as like that slow, wet, weepy, like takes a day for it to happen, freaking everything's beautiful after that.
Yep.
Like I really enjoy some mornings. Like, I know it's going to rain like that. You go out, you take a picture, and then you take a picture the next day at the same time. And the green difference, like, it's almost like especially when there's electrical storms. I think that's something to do with pushing nitrogen in the water. Like the green is almost ethereal. Like it doesn't even make sense how different that green becomes.
Yeah. Yeah. The ozone too. I think the ozone that's introduced, or O3, is meaningful in that process. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think understanding all these different concepts and being able to start putting them together as you design out your property, realizing that water getting into your soil a little bit more slowly means less evaporation and, you know, basically better holding capacity. And so you become less worried about, oh, it's not dripping quite as fast as it should, or that is quite as I saw on this YouTube video on how to set up drip irrigation. You start worrying less about the things that don't actually matter and more about the things that do actually matter.
Yeah. If you wanted a 0.5 gallon per emitter or something, whatever your number was, if it takes 15 minutes or it takes 30 minutes, you don't care.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you're sitting there blowing pressure into the tube to make it to come out and you're going to pass out. I mean, it does it. You set a timer and walk away, you know? And then, like I said, that slow movement, like a lot of what we do from a earthwork standpoint is about slow and spread.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole point. Anyway, we want that water to take a long, slow path. And even with a lot of water, we still want it slow, because fast moving water, one, goes away, and two, takes things with it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. My poor neighbor, you know, before we became friends and I started helping her with stuff, she listened to the NRCS and the USDA about her soil samples, and she's on a pretty steep hill and she was raising sheep.
Yeah.
And she sprayed it all with 2,4-D to get rid of some of the weed, you know, a handful of weeds she didn't want. And now the hill, I'm not joking, it looks like Mars. Right? The sheep have nothing to eat and everything ran downhill. And now one part of her fence is like that high because there's so much soil that, you know, it's the low point.
The bottom.
Yeah, the soil just started building up behind the fence, you know, leaves and debris, and then the soil got stuck behind that, and so she's lost most of her topsoil. And if somebody had just slowed down that water, used stone lines or something similar, where you're spreading out the water and letting it trickle through in all kinds of places, but you're moving it away from the valley and towards the peak. And then thinking again about contour, and the water is going to run 90 degrees off contour. Now that water is spread out instead of being consolidated into that valley.
Yeah.
It's being moved out to those peaks, and it's not going to come back into the valley for quite a while because it's out further. And she's got plenty of stone that, you know, we could have gone and put in a couple of really rudimentary stone lines and avoided that disaster altogether.
One of the most underrated, inexpensive, and easiest things in the world is stone lines.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you explain what a stone line is for people that are like, we don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Yeah. So I've got a whole video on it if people want to go to my YouTube page and watch it, but I'll try to give you, you know, the audio version of it.
Yeah.
So the biggest pushback I got on doing that video was, oh, it's just a retaining wall. And in a sense, it kind of is, but it's like, you know, a Corvette is a vehicle and a F-150 is a vehicle, and right, they're different vehicles.
They do different things.
Yeah. So stone line basically is you take stones and you put them on the contour of the land. So at a level, level across the plain or across the landscape on contour. And then as water and debris and other things run downhill, they hit that and they spread out. In my case, I put it right below my chicken coop and run. And so, cause all my hill, my entire property is a hill and it slopes. So I don't have a flat place for my chicken run. And so when my chickens are making compost for me with wood chips and chicken poop and all the other stuff we throw in there, that ends up downhill and it's just going to go into my neighbor's property. So what I did is I put a stone line just downhill from that. And as the chickens kick and scratch and all that, it then hits those stones, builds up, the water spreads out, it slows down, it soaks in, and I also catch all that organic matter.
Mm.
So now that's a little orchard, and it's really simple to put in. So it's simpler than swales in that you just, once you find the contour, which is fairly easy, again, I've got a bunch of videos on that, Then you just take the stones and you set them in place on that contour. And depending on your slope, you might cut in just a little bit to keep the stones from rolling downhill or whatever. But it's incredibly simple, and it can really improve, not only improve your soil, but spread out the water, help with soakage, help with drainage issues. Yeah, it's just an incredibly simple technology, I guess.
It is a technology. I'll tell you who I blame for this idea that we must kill the weeds and leave everything alone is the people behind the crying Indian from the 1980s. He was crying because of pollution, but it's going to sound crazy until I pull it together. So it's the mythology, like the Native American was completely soft on the land. They didn't touch anything. They lived in harmony with nature and did almost no disturbance. And this is asinine. I also think it's very insulting because you're taking this group of millions of people that spans two continents and you're homogenizing them as all the same. But they were very active ecosystem managers. And just because we didn't recognize it when we got here doesn't mean it wasn't what it was. And so we developed this ethos from about the 60s forward of this, the red man's ways, and don't touch anything and leave nothing but footprints, and basically do not be an active participant, be a visitor in nature. And so it leads to this idea that all I have to do to fix this thing that, by the way, we fucked up in that case by spraying herbicide or in some other way, is leave it alone and nature will repair the damage. Okay. Tell that to the Grand Canyon. Right. It's going to be a canyon forever, even though nature did it. Right. It's not going to, you're not going to see Bermuda grass growing on a piece of the Grand Canyon anytime soon, because that erosion is so excessive, and we can do micro versions of that. So an instance of this is there's a nature center about 5 miles from my house we hike at, and they got this area. And I was talking to the lady that, you know, takes care of everything, and it's just this wash, and it's all caliche, you know. Which is like crumbled up limestone rock, and like nothing's growing on it. Why y'all? They had it all blocked off. No one but walk on it, right? And I said, what are you doing with that? She goes, we need to give it time to repair itself. It's about a 60-degree slope of caliche.
Yeah, that's not going to repair itself.
You are out of here. So I was trying to explain it to her, and this is not a dumb person, right? She's probably got a degree in ecology or some shit, but you could see like her brain trying to accept what I was telling her, but her training just like Jedi repelling that shit. Like, keep that away from my brain. I don't want that in there. I was explaining like this would be a perfect thing, you know, application for gabions, which is basically a stone line in a different way.
Yeah.
And if you put like a gabion row there, and I was showing her, I had my little flashlight with the laser pointer. I'm like, right across here, right across here, right across here, then you'd have deposition traps, and this could actually start to restore itself. And she said, well, we have experts here that know what they're doing. And that's where I just shut up, right? But I think, like, your friend wasn't that person, but in a way they were, because the idea was once this gets damaged, then all we have to do is just, like, don't put the sheep on there, and it'll come back. Well, it's not coming back.
Right.
Some of these places will slowly repair, but some of them will never repair without us, or they won't repair in a human lifetime. But something like stone lines or gabions or swales and some active management can actually restore these things that we've damaged. And I think, again, we have this ecological fairy tale, you know, that, that in all cases, the best thing to do is nothing. And yeah, you know, we've had, even no matter how many people, Jeff Lawton proving it with swell based design architecture, Alan Savory doing it with cattle, right? I mean, like, totally different methodology, same real principle, completely restoring dry land ecosystems.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in my neighbor's case where I was talking about, she's got these giant gullies. It looks like Mars because we've got red clay here. The actual probably best and easiest fix, and I'm not suggesting anybody do this because you need to know all the nuances, but is kudzu.
Oh yeah. Yeah. For her.
If we fenced out those areas that are really badly damaged, put a little stone line above them to spread the water out a bit, so it isn't going down quite as fast, planted kudzu and let our sheep graze around it, so the kudzu never got out of that space, it would restore that soil. It would bring it back to having some type of roots in it.
Yeah.
And then once that established, we pull the fencing out, let the animals graze, and then things will start popping up below the kudzu because the sheep will eat the crap out of kudzu.
Oh, they will.
So that would probably be the cheapest, easiest, most effective way to deal with it. I don't think I really want to put kudzu on our land or near my land, but you know, like if managed properly, it's actually an incredible restorative agent to the system.
And maybe you wouldn't want to do it there because it's not there yet, but there's a lot of places where people are all freaked out about that. And you're like, do you not see what lines your entire road? Right? Like they're worried about kudzu. It's like, you already have all the kudzu.
Right.
Or you already have all the kudzu. And, you know, sheep, goats, grazing it is the way to manage it and control it and turn it into an asset.
Yeah.
That's why it was originally brought here.
Turn it into vodka. I don't know.
Yeah.
Whatever you want to do with it.
Tubers are huge. And that's part of why it's so persistent, as the tubers are huge, but they're basically a giant carbohydrate reserve. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you can make alcohol out of it too, but a bitch to dig up. I will say that about it. We're not saying to go plant kudzu. We are saying that you have to be creative and is the horse out of the barn. Cause like we have this mass ban on like water hyacinths in Texas, as though the climate where I live, where it was freezing 2 days ago, is the same as south of Houston. Like just cause it's the same state. Right. So it doesn't survive up here in the wild. Down there where it does survive, and you know, they're literally writing tickets because somebody has it like a water garden in their backyard or something. What do you think you're accomplishing? You can't drive by a bar ditch that's not full of it. And they're like, see, it's invasive. Yes.
It's already there.
It's there. Now, if it wasn't there and you brought it in there, then you're kind of an ecological asshole. Mm-hmm. Who brought it there in the first place, might we just say?
Yeah.
Was it some guy with an aquarium hobby, or did the government plant the kudzu? Did the government plant the autumn olive? Did the government bring the water hyacinth to Jacksonville, Florida to clog the St. John's River? It was the government that brought all this shit in. Then they want to punish somebody for possessing it. It's kind of nuts. It's not really the subject today, but.
Well, then Monsanto can function stack on top of that and sell them some herbicides to get rid of whoever.
Yeah.
Monsanto doesn't exist anymore.
There's another water management hack there, and like things like water hyacinth, water lettuce and stuff like that. Like one of my friends, basically, he turned his swimming pool into a pond.
Mm-hmm.
All this aquaponic stuff around. He has these big towers. He'll grow things like sweet potato, and they're just basically a loop of horse fence. And he'll take like sweet potato in there and he'll weave it in and out. And every time you weave another vine back through, he'll add more material. Well, all he's doing is taking the water hyacinth and water lettuce and shit out of his pond. Mm-hmm. And throwing it on top of that vine. And then it just like the water just weaves out of it. And so you've got this basically hydro tower. And by the end of the season, you know, it's full. It's 3 foot high piece of this 3 foot high tower. It's completely full of the most beautiful black compost you've ever seen. It never needs to be watered because every day he's throwing handfuls of that shit into it. And then when you pull it off and dump out the compost, it's just full of sweet potatoes.
Yeah.
Right. But that's a water management strategy. That's something like people don't realize like that. That's not that's a compost system. It's also a active growing system, but it's also a water management strategy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you can see like there's places in Africa where things like water hyacinth have basically taken over these lakes. And realistically, people could be pulling that material out, using it for compost. Like the problem can become the solution because that plant is cleaning the lake, but it's also doing damage to the ecology. So,
Yeah. Okay,
let's harvest it mechanically, but you put it to good use. Now it can go onto farmlands and all that runoff that's coming from farmlands that we should fix before it's runoff, but we're not. Now we can take it back to the farmland because it's showing up in water hyacinth, right?
Yeah. That water hyacinth is something we need to develop an industrial level method of harvesting so it becomes an asset, because what's been tried hasn't worked very well. There's a couple lakes in Africa that have been completely taken over by it. So they ordered the government gets some ideas together, gets some people together. They ordered these two barges that are going to pile the hyacinth up so they can harvest it. And they're going to make like chicken feed out of it and shit. So they put out the lake and they were dumb enough to run them both simultaneously. It took about 15 minutes for both of them to sink. Because when it first comes out, it's carrying a lot of water with it, and it's very freaking heavy. And so they needed some way to like drain off the decks, and some so they gave up on that. But the St. John's River is the place in the United States that we have the most issues with it. And if they could do that, they could probably, you know, people don't think of Florida as a place that grows cattle, but there's a lot of cattle raised in Florida. You could probably feed every cow in the state from just the water hyacinth out of the St. John's.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're back to a water management issue. And now it becomes an asset because the St. John's is not exactly a pristine, clear river. And that's the other thing. Like hyacinth grows in places that are polluted and high nutrient. That right. same lake in Africa, they had a huge rain event one year and it basically flushed the lake out. All the hyacinth died.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as that nutrient level went down and it took what was left, it killed itself basically. And I mean, I can see that in like my, my garden ponds. I'll throw it in there to keep the evaporation down and all. And late to the season, all of a sudden it starts to yellow up because that nutrient load in that pond has gone down so much at that point of the year. So it's not the problem people think it is. Kudzu, it can be a problem. Yeah. Go to Atlanta.
Well, if we were not scared of red meat and we used grazing animals, kudzu would never be an issue.
Especially like you said, like the easiest thing I think to raise for meat that's easily processed is like hair sheep, mm-hmm. like your Dorpers and your Katahdins and stuff like that. They'll eat the shit out of that.
Oh yeah.
I mean, they'll eat that before they eat anything else.
Yep. It's Matt the Welder, by the way, but yes, look up Matt the Welder. He's very libertarian minded, but he's got all these awesome videos about how bad government is and how they're destroying the ecological systems, the water systems in
Florida. In the name of protecting them often. That's, you know,
yep.
We have this incredibly dirty fucking river. Let's get rid of the plant that filters the dirty shit out of the river.
With a poison. That then clogs the fish's gills.
Yeah. Well, that's it. So that's one thing for people that are using these water plants you need to know. Hyacinth does this, but water lettuce does this even more. When that plant goes to the critical nutrient load and it starts to die, it drops roots. And then mm-hmm. the hairs of those roots mechanically infiltrate the gills of fish and causes massive fish kills.
Yep.
And people say the plant killed the fish. Well, in a way, you killed the plant and the dead plant material killed the fish. That's what actually happened. And I had a conversation. I was actually working sort of with a small city government in the north side of the Dallas side of the Metroplex. And that was another one of those things where like you could see the mind understanding it. And then eventually the mind going, I do not want to understand this because my job depends on me not understanding this. So I'm going to pretend that I don't understand it. Like, you know,
The cognitive dissonance is always interesting watching, you know, this is a little off topic, but
no, it's not, you
know, throwing ideas at people. And, you know, I've had people talking about, you know, just random conspiracy theory, all the things that have now been proven true that I was crazy for thinking before. And them going, how can you possibly function if you believe all that? And I'm like, how can you function if you block out reality? Right.
Yeah.
But it's because, you know, they might lose their job because of it. They might lose their livelihood. Their friends might not be as, there's all this social pressure, you know, that your kind of typical NPCs deal with that, us weirdos don't. Or as much, at least, because we don't care as much, that keep people from recognizing what's true and thinking through it enough to go, okay, I've figured out that this might cost me my job. Maybe it'll gain me a job somewhere else. Or maybe if I think it through and come up with a solution, it'll solidify my job. But they want to stop at this is scary part.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's like, especially bureaucratic positions. If you do everything in the book, no matter what happens, you keep your job.
Mm-hmm.
That it's the reverse. It's not so much the fear of losing a job. It's the absolute knowledge that if I follow procedure and I don't like rob a post office, I'll retire here.
Right.
So, like, and if I do buck the system and I am right and it goes as good as possible and it becomes policy, I still won't get, I'm not going to get promoted for it.
Right.
So that's where you're like high risk, zero or low reward. I got to be fair to those guys. I'm not doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, like I'm high risk, high reward, but I am not high risk for low reward. That's logical. And that's, you know, Charlie Munger always said, you want to know the problem with the system, look for the incentive.
Mm-hmm.
The incentive will tell you everything about the problem, or if it's a high quality system, high quality output, then it has the right incentives in it. Yeah. On that note, like this is good kind of anchor question to kind of finish up with, and I'm going to have to go let that dog back in the house. If you were had a brand new homesteader in front of you, right? They got their homestead. I'm going to do this. I'm going to put the things over there and I'm going to get the chickens. And they really haven't even thought about water. And then they hear this today and they're like, well, I need to put in good quality water management system. What would you walk them through in figuring out how to do it and what would work best for them? Because that's a big ass. It depends.
Oh yeah. It's a huge, it depends. So yeah, the first thing I would do is ask what your goals are. So, I've got kind of like, about 10 goals that I have people fill out on a questionnaire before I even take them on as a client. And the point is so that I can see what they're aiming at or what they're looking to do. What are the highest priorities for them? And so making sure that they've thought through the priorities that are actually important for the goals that they want to pursue is the first thing. And so once you know what your goals are and what you're actually wanting to do, then you can start putting together a system or a systematic approach that ties all these systems together, including the water with the soil or the, you know, animals or the whatever. So it really has to do with putting your goals down, thinking through what you're wanting to accomplish on your homestead, narrowing those down to be something reasonable, and then putting them in order so that you can figure out where and how the water plays into all of that.
And of course, I missed most of that.
That's okay. I was just talking about goals, you know, making your goals up front so that you know what that system should look like. And then you have to look at the property too, obviously, because different properties are going to have totally different possibilities and ways that make the most sense. And so that's where the huge, it depends comes in, is how is your property laid out? Where can you collect water from? What kinds of things you can do earthworks wise? Is it worth it? Does it meet your goals? All that. So yeah, mm-hmm. Big, it depends on all of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the goal start point is probably the most important thing there, because I could go look at a property and say, well, there's the elevation change, there's the opportunity for catchment and all, and I can come up with a great hydrological design for the property, but mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if it doesn't meet the goals of the person that has the property, that owns the property, and what they want to do. You know, if I had my way, what I want is a big ass pond full of fish.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, but the landowner that you're talking to may not want that at all. Right. But they might want is a great big forest full of productive trees.
Yeah.
I still think pond belongs there, but it's not my I don't, you know, what does that person want out of it? What do they mm-hmm. want short term, midterm, long term out of the property? Why are they doing it?
Yeah.
Then you have to go within, like you were saying, the kind of the scope and the boundaries of the property. Like, how much catchment do I really have available to me on a half acre urban lot? And the answer is not much.
But there's things you can do.
There's right? things you can do. But what I'm kind of saying is I could have a half acre lot more in the country, let's say backing up to like state easement or something like that, where they're never going to build anything like state park land or something like that. But if it's set up right, I've got all that catchment.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I don't even have to have the land to benefit from the catchment if the catchment's there. And if the flow is right, but if it's mm-hmm. the backyard of a neighborhood with a bunch of 6-foot privacy fences, I pretty much have what I have, and I have to operate differently, even if otherwise the land's almost the same.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so my direct neighbor downhill is looking at building a house, but currently they have a barn that used to be part of my homestead, and the water channels right through the barn, and it's destroying this 100-plus-year-old barn. And he's like, I don't know what I'm going to do because he just bought the property. And I'm like, well, we could move the water on my side of the property. I don't mind putting in a little, you know, a little swale or something, because that's what should have been done all along. It's just not my property. So I've on their side. So I've never even looked in that barn.
Yeah.
No. So yeah, there's almost always a solution. It's just how good of a solution is it? Does it meet your goals? You know, are you going to get the department of making you sad coming out and bothering you about it? All those things, you know, need to be considered in it.
You help people directly, right, with design decisions and things like that. Tell people a little bit about what it's like to work with you, and like, where do you work with people? Like, you know, Nick Ferguson, if you pay him enough, he'll get in a truck and drive to Washington State. Right. Do you do that, or do you kind of work regionally?
So I generally work regionally.
Okay.
I have done some travel. I've also done some distance consults to the extent it's feasible.
Yeah.
And I'm just like Nick, you know, I'll travel wherever if you pay me enough.
Sure.
But what I prefer to do is I've actually got a network of guys who do the same stuff I do. So we can bounce ideas off of each other, and you know, we also, I'm a lot more technical than some of the guys. So if they've got like water issues like this, they'll oftentimes call me in as a separate consultant. So we work together a lot, and I've been able to find people like somebody in California that's got a totally different ecosystem than I'm used to called me about a consultation because my name comes up on Google so easily. And I was like, you know what? I could charge you a whole bunch to come out there and then not be available when you actually need me on site to figure things out. Or I could just talk to my network of guys and see if anybody knows anybody out in your region. And we found somebody half an hour away from her, and you know, we were able to, and that person knows that area really well and is able to be there if needed. So, yes, I'll travel, but I try to talk myself out of a job if I can find somebody else or something else that's more viable for that person. Does that make sense?
No, it absolutely makes sense. I have people often ask me, why do you have a speaker's agreement on your site? Because it implies I'm going to say yes.
Right.
I don't want to go anywhere. I like being here, you know. It's not that I want to go anywhere. I don't want to go all the time. Like, I'm a podcaster, not a consultant, so I really don't want to go. But
right.
Yeah, I think there's, for people doing what you're doing, there's enough work in a region to keep you busy for the rest of your life, honestly. And I think you're in a great region, by the way. I mean, there's a lot of opportunity there. And when I say I'm not about business, I'm talking about land opportunity. Like it is, it's a great growing zone. It's got relatively decent soils. It's got most of the year reasonable rainfall. It's got good elevation changes, lots of rivers, creeks, springs. Like you've got a lot of natural assets there that, like where I live, yeah, my property's a little bit extreme, but even, you know, go down the road where they don't have my particular problems, they still don't have those natural assets available to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And that kind of goes back to my point of there's enough work for an entire lifetime. That's part of why I work with these other guys. And, you know, whether it's Kerry Brown, who's another council member, or Nick Ferguson or whoever, it's really more about letting people know that we exist, the job that we do exists, and that it's beneficial. And kind of my elevator pitch to people is, if I can't take you on as a client and save you dramatically more money than you're spending for me to be there, then I'm not going to take you on as a client. But there is so much work. It's really more about getting the word out to say, hey, you could save a ton of headache by just hiring me or somebody like me. If you don't like me, if I'm annoying to you, you know, I've got other guys who do the same stuff, who I can trust, who, you know, have good moral character and will help you out with what you're trying to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, folks, again, the website that you can check out is thehomesteadconsultant.com. Ryan also has Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, X, all of it. So I'll make sure all those things are in the video or the audio notes for today. If you're watching us on video, right down there in the video notes, there's a link to get over to my website where the audio version will be published about 30 minutes after we wrap up here. So if you're still watching us live and ain't there yet, if you're on the Memorex version, it's probably already there, and you can get access to all that. Before you go, can you hang out and answer a few questions here for some people?
Absolutely. And if we get a chance, I'd love to plug my Swales class.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I had that noted, and I forgot. We'll hit that, too, after the question. So
awesome.
Mick says, if you use biochar in your coop to mitigate smell, et cetera, does that char survive to when you make the compost and put it in the soil and still have value of retaining water? I'll give you the short answer, yes, and you can explain it further if you want.
Oh, yeah, it has way more capacity when you put it in the soil, because not only is it going to likely have broken that, you know, hydrophobic stage that can be tough to get past, now that you've got, you're basically introducing the chicken poop, so you're introducing all the microbes and things, and they're kicking it and turning it and breaking it down into smaller pieces. So there's more, I don't, like in wood chips, I call it end grain. I don't know what you'd call it in biochar, but basically there's more access to those little capillaries.
Surface area.
Yeah. There's more surface area for the water to actually hit, soak into that. And you've also got the biological life, which is going to help with the moving and the fungal life and everything else that's going to move into that like an apartment. And just bring you a whole lot more benefit. So, it's actually going to be better after you run it through your chicken coop than it otherwise would be.
I'll concur, and I like to call it a high cycle item. I want to use biochar because it's so diverse, as high in the cycle as possible. So this is actually exactly what I do. I build bioreactors every year, usually build 2 to 3 of them. The primary input is coop material from a duck coop. I do deep litter, cleaning out once a year. Every time I throw down a bale or two or a couple of wheelbarrows of wood chips in there, I dump a 5-gallon bucket of biochar all over the coop. It does keep the stink down. It reduces the fly population, and the birds actually will eat it too. They won't eat all of it. That ain't going to happen, but they eat quite a bit of it. And then that passes through their system and they deposit it on the land. So that's good. But by doing that, we get all that functionality in the coop about stench and absorption and not having flies. Well, then when we move that into the compost, you don't, like when you use biochar generally, you have to do something to it before you put it in the land. We don't want to use raw char. It will eventually solve its own problem, but initially, since it is so sponge-like, and it's not just sponge-like, you know, Ryan was talking about like cations and stuff like that. There's a level of like electrical charge that actually causes things to adhere to it. And so it's kind of like dropping a sponge into a bowl of water. It's going to take a lot of water and then slowly give it back. And so if we don't, you know, put it in compost, charge it up with compost tea, add organic fertilizer when we put it down or something like that, we can actually create a deficit in our plants. When it's in compost, you don't have to do anything. It's raring and ready to go, and it lasts thousands and thousands. We're not even really sure how long it lasts. Some people go to the extreme and it's forever, and some people say it's, you know, it's 5 years, and it's somewhere in the thousands of years. There's soils known as terra preta down in South America that they can identify these pieces and components of charcoal that are still in them that they know are at least 6,000-7,000 years old. Mm-hmm. So is it forever? For the purpose of your life? Yeah. Yeah. Yep. If you figure out how to live to be 7,000, let me know. We're all going to be rich and we don't care about the biochar anymore. We're going to be good, you know?
Yeah. One, and I did a podcast recently with a friend about, you know, there's this proverb that goes, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that seventh generational thinking where biochar is going to be handed down. You know, if you hand down your property and you actually steward it and take care of it, it can be handed down generation after generation. And that little bit of biochar that you took the time to put into the soil is going to be there for longer than our brains can comprehend.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, think about our country's about to turn 250 years old this year.
Mm-hmm.
That's a blip on the longevity of pyrolyzed carbon, because that's what biochar really is. It's pyrolyzed carbonous material. And it, like I said, for the purpose of our lives, it's eternal. Homesteading Heathen gave us a $4.99 super sticker. Thank you for that, sir. Thanks, I appreciate it. Heartland Acres, can you make, oh, just a comment, you could make IMO bath. I guess that's when you're talking about compost tea bath.
Yep.
So IMO, indigenous microorganisms, that's not really in my wheelhouse. I play with a little bit, but I have no doubt that that's true. And it's kind of, you're playing with the same organisms.
Yeah. And IMO are indigenous microorganisms. You can pull them from just about any forest, but if you're going to do that, find the healthiest, oldest growth forest you can to pull those IMOs from, because that's going to be, you know, if you can find a true old growth forest, that's gold. You're going to find a balance of microorganisms. That's going to be incredible.
And Anarchy 6 just threw us a 777 super chat. Says, thank you for having this uber knowledgeable homestead consultant on great info. So I get the money and you get the compliment. That works. That works for me, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, man, I really appreciate you again, guys. TheHomesteadConsultant.com. If you want to work with Ryan, like he said, he works mostly regionally, but he can do some consultation long distance as well. He's got a network he can tie into, and he also has, well, let's see, remove ad. You wanted to talk about this. So
yeah. Thanks for letting me pump my class.
Yeah.
So, April 11th, this year, I'm doing a class out in Hartsville, Tennessee, which is kind of like North Central Tennessee, but we're going to cover a mini swales workshop. So it's going to be primarily hand dug, small scale, orchard type swales for water management. But I'm going to go over everything all the way from kind of a classroom setting to, you know, using laser levels, A-frame levels, finding contour, and then actually digging and planting out some swales. It's going to be $50, and it's kind of like, you know, Jack's Being Dangerous with ChatGPT class, where he did one where it was a lot less expensive and now you're paying the full price. This is going to be a introductory price for the first time I run it, because I realize there's going to be things I need to learn about a workshop that that I'm going to screw up. So I'm giving you a better price because of it. But it's a full day workshop on April 11th, 9 a.m. out in Hartsville, Tennessee, for $50. And if you want to be a part of it, just email me at thehomesteadconsultant@gmail.com and I'll get you set up.
Yeah, I'm going to have to find out what you're using for a laser level too, the brand. That's going to have to end up going on my T-Spaz, because I had not checked the price of these things since I bought one. And I bought one in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
So they were like, your entry level product was $500 back then. Kind of the step up I went was like $800. Mm-hmm. And I just pulled that up on Amazon and I see a whole bunch of them for like $100, $75. And I don't know if that's what you're using or if they're good enough for this kind of work, but that wasn't an option.
Right.
When I invested in mine.
So there's a couple ways to go on this if you actually want me to answer it.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So I just a couple days ago released a video specifically on my favorite laser level for this, because it has it's a pro grade, almost pro grade laser level for about $250, it's got a receiver.
Okay.
So the receiver is really important for being able to use it during the daylight.
Yeah.
And so I've got a whole video on how to do it, plus all the links. So if you want to steal those links to put in T-Spaz, you can. But if you want to do it like at sunset, you can get away with one of those like $50,
okay, you know,
cheapo Home Depot ones.
Yeah.
You know, cobalt or whatever.
Yeah.
And just using a yardstick, and you can do it and do it accurately. It's just not as nice as having the receiver in a full fledged system. No.
But it sounds like what I paid $800 for, you can buy for $200 to $300 today. And that's
correct.
It is a tool that you will never appreciate until you own it and use it. Now, I will also say, if you live in a half acre flat backyard, you don't need one unless you're going to do some really cool concrete work or something. But if you live on property that has variable terrain and you want to maximize earthworks, it's you can now buy for less than one day rental on your excavator. And if you're going to excavate something, you need one of these. I think this is what Ryan wants to talk about here.
Yeah, that's it. It's the Dovo, or Dovo. Wish I could get it to say the name better, but, it's a great little unit. And, I've used it quite a bit and been really happy with it.
Well, I'll look that up It's just expensive enough that since I don't need one, I probably won't buy one to review, but I do trust your recommendations wholeheartedly. So maybe we'll add that to the catalog. Thanks for being with us today, man. And again, guys, check out thehomesteadconsultant.com and get on over to the audio version at thesurvivalpodcast.com of this episode, episode 3818. If you're listening to it like 6 months after we did it, just go there and go to the search box on thesurvivalpodcast.com and put 3818 in. And this is for you guys that are on audio too, that aren't here in the video, don't have a link. You can always look up any episode. You put Ryan Steven in, but he's been on a lot. But if you put 3818 in, you're going to find one or two episodes that have that in it, maybe. And you're going to be able to real quick drill down to it. So, Ryan, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Jack.
All right, folks. Well, I really appreciate everybody being here today. I appreciate Ryan being here today. I wanted to throw a couple things here at the end, though, for you guys to know about. One, I realize I don't talk about this enough. If you go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on subscribe, and you might be thinking, but Jack, I'm already subscribed. I follow you on Apple, or I follow you on Pocket Cast, or I follow you on YouTube or whatever. Yeah, and you can find out about that there, too. But you can also fill out a real quick web form. And that's for the daily mail. And if you fill out that web form, you get about one email a day from me, about 4 days a week, because I don't do it over the weekend and I take Fridays off. You'll get an email. All it says is, here's what's new on the site. It'll tell you the daily episode, the item of the day, and anything special going on. It's text only. It's not high-speed marketing or anything like that. It's just so you stay informed. And because it's text only, it's highly deliverable. I don't trip a lot of spam filters or whatever. And if you're not on the Daily Mail and you don't want to miss things, you probably should get on the Daily Mail. And one of the things you'll find out in the Daily Mail is what the item of the day is. And the item of the day today are these galvanized raised beds, these metal raised beds made by, in this particular case, a company called Freezone. These are great. And you might look at this like it's 2 feet wide, it's 8 feet long, and it's 2 feet deep. And it looks like a stock tank, like an oval stock tank. How the hell can Amazon mail that to you, shipping included, for $110? Well, it doesn't come put together. You put it together. So it comes in a set of panels. It ships in a fairly flat box. You can put one of these. I always rate my assembly jobs on beers. How many beers do I have to drink while I'm putting it together to not get pissed off while I'm putting it together? This is a one beer job. It's just sticking some bolts through some holes and putting some nuts on them, and then you go ahead and fill it up. This is the most cost-effective way I know to put in raised beds. I really should get Kelly Heron on the show. This is a guy that did a lot of video work for us back in the day, the Permaethos days. He just put a bunch of these in inside a greenhouse. It looks really awesome. Raised beds are not right for everything. If Ryan was still here with us, he'd probably tell you, you can grow in the ground, grow in the ground. But there's places where they make a lot of sense, like where you don't have any soil or other reasons. And some people just want them because they're nice and convenient and they're clean lines, easy to maintain. And, you know, you can start out with great soil. I've had people buy things like this and go ahead and just basically compost them until they're full with compost. And then they're full. It takes a while, but you can do that too. Check these things out. They're on. The reason I'm bringing around, they're on sale today. They usually cost right around $145-$150 a piece. I don't think you can build a 4x8x2 foot deep raised bed out of pressure treated lumber for $150 anymore with the price of things. These are on sale for $110, and they'll last a long damn time. Super easy to put together, quick, and again, a one beer job. With that, guys, just remember you can always support me anytime by doing your online shopping, starting at tspaz.com, T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Again, all of Ryan's resources will be on the audio side for you. Check that about 1.5 hour after we're done here live, which is right now. Tomorrow I'll catch you with Expert Counsel Show. You might even hear from Ryan again tomorrow. I'm not sure what I have in the queue right now. And then we will be back on Monday with another live. We do live 3 days a week. So please check us out Monday through Wednesday for the live. They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have.